From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the US slaps Russia with fresh sanctions as the separatist unrest and violence in eastern Ukraine continues.
We should react swiftly and in a very tough manner to push back. Whether the sanctions will have an immediate impact on what they do in the Ukraine, that I doubt.
Also today, we look at the increasingly deadly risks of transporting oil by rail in the United States. And we speak to Doctors Without Borders after three members are killed alongside several civilians in the Central African Republic.
Three of those 16 bodies were members of our national staff, and 13 of the people had been killed were some of our guests that had come earlier in the afternoon to have a discussion with us on access to healthcare in the area.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama has announced that the U.S. is hitting Russia with a new round of sanctions in response to what it called Moscow's continued illegal intervention in Ukraine. Seven Russian government officials will come under an asset freeze and U.S. visa ban, and 17 companies linked to Vladimir Putin's inner circle will also be affected. Lorna Shattuck reports from Washington.
Igor Sechin, the president of Russia's state-owned oil company Rosneft, is among the seven officials being targeted by these latest sanctions. Others include Alexei Pushkov, the chairman of the State Duma's International Affairs Committee, and Vladimir Putin's deputy chief of staff. 13 Russian companies will face additional sanctions, as the U.S. government will cut off the export or re-export of American-made products to them. The State and Commerce Departments have also announced they'll now deny export licenses for high-tech items that could contribute to Russia's military capabilities. White House officials say they decided to impose the new sanctions last week after determining that Russia hadn't lived up to its commitments under the agreement signed in Geneva earlier this month.
A new U.S. security agreement signed on Monday with the Philippines is not aimed at controlling China. That's the message from President Barack Obama as he wraps up a four-nation tour of Asia. The 10-year deal gives the U.S. temporary access to selected military bases in the Philippines, but is widely seen as a bid by Washington to counter China in the region. Nina Maria Potts has more.
The security agreement was signed just as U.S. President Barack Obama arrived in the Philippines. The deal gives American forces temporary access to selected military camps. The move is being widely seen as a bid to contain Chinese territorial aggression. But President Obama insists this is about partnering with China in upholding international law. His visit to the Philippines is the last stop of a week-long trip to Asia that also took in Japan, South Korea, and Malaysia. The president has made a series of pledges reaffirming U.S. treaty commitments to defending its allies in the region. His visit to the Philippines has sparked some protests among activists who accuse the U.S. of a military buildup in Asia.
In Egypt, a judge has sentenced 683 people to death in a mass trial. Those charged include Muslim Brotherhood leader Mohamed Badi, sentenced over a 2013 attack at a police station. The White House says they are deeply troubled by the news of the mass sentencing. The judge also commuted the death sentences of 492 people who were tried in March. They now face life in prison. Musicians Paul Simon and his wife Edie Brickell have been arrested and charged with disorderly conduct. The pair were arrested following an apparent domestic dispute on Saturday night at their home in the U.S. state of Connecticut. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. At least 18 are dead after tornadoes rampaged across the American states of Oklahoma and Arkansas. Tornadoes are common for the American Midwest as the winter weather season changes to the summer weather pattern. Priscilla Huff has the details.
The Storm Prediction Center, based in Norman, Oklahoma, reported 30 confirmed tornadoes. The mayor of the tiny town of Valonia, Arkansas, says his downtown is leveled and at least 10 fatalities have been reported. The huge twisters also tore through Oklahoma and Kansas, destroying homes and tossing cars like toys. The death toll is expected to rise as search and rescue efforts continue. Americans in the states of Arkansas, Tennessee, and Mississippi are expected to witness the next round of violent thunderstorms and tornadoes.
British publicist Max Clifford has been found guilty of 8 indecent assault charges at his trial in London's Southwark Crown Court. The jury cleared him of two counts of assault and was unable to reach a verdict on one other. It's the first conviction under Operation U-Tree, which sprang out of allegations of abuse by former BBC star Jimmy Savile. Syria has missed another deadline for the removal and destruction of its chemical weapons stockpile. However, the United Nations mission overseeing the task says the Syrian government is still on target for the final June date. Nick Harper reports from UN headquarters in New York.
Sunday came and went without the Syrian government keeping to its promise to export around 1,200 tons of chemical weapons. That date was created after several other earlier deadlines were missed. The UN task force says around 7.5% of the stockpile remains. However, it's still confident the 30th of June deadline for the removal and destruction of all of Syria's chemical weapons will be met.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The United States has slapped sanctions on 7 Russian individuals and 17 companies it says are closely connected to Vladimir Putin. The White House said the move was in direct response to Russia's continued illegal intervention in Ukraine. Problems for Moscow mounted as the European Union said it would also expand its sanctions against Russia. Meanwhile, unrest shows little sign of dying down in eastern Ukraine, where 8 European military observers are being held by pro-Russian separatists, and where the mayor of the city of Kharkiv was shot and critically wounded. Former Hungarian ambassador to the US, András Simonyi, gave me his reaction to the sanctions.
I think it's important. I think it's important to tighten the sanctions regime. I'd also like to say that it's good that the U.S. is taking leadership on this. And my sense is that the European Union slowly but steadily will follow suit. And I think that's important. Also, it seems to me that we're closing the gap between the U.S. and Europe on Russia. That's good.
Do you feel that this expansion of the sanctions list from the White House has gone far enough?
Well, I would say... I personally don't think it's gone far enough, but I think it's a step in the right direction. The question really is, what's happening in the inner circles of Putin right now? Mm-hmm. Is this going to start a serious debate about, hey, wait a minute, are we going in the right direction? Or will there be more volunteers for sanctions? Because what we have seen is many of the key actors have been wearing the sanctions as a badge of honor.
Indeed.
as a sign of loyalty to Putin. So I have, at this moment, I cannot judge what exactly will be the result, but I think we should keep pressing. One more thing. I think it's important that we started targeting the energy sector.
Well, didn't the United States, the White House suggested that indeed that could follow next?
Yeah, I think it's a strong message, because unless that happens, they will not feel the pain. And in my personal view, I think in terms of the energy sector, I think the Europeans need to get tough on that. I think European leaders have to explain to their populations that this might be or will be painful. And one more thing, nobody has talked about other aspects of the energy sector than gas, but I think we should expand that, for example, to include nuclear plants. And I think all the agreements that are in the pipeline, that are just in the pipeline, should be revisited, should be rediscussed. And I think both the European Union and the U.S. should block further agreements until the crisis is resolved.
Ambassador, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov said Moscow's response would be painful for Washington. It's a little bit vague, but what do you think that response could include?
Well, I have no idea what they're talking about. Obviously, they're not talking about economic sanctions, because that would be ridiculous.
Right.
I think they have there are all kinds of possibilities to disrupt international negotiations, international processes. I have no idea what they're talking about, but that should not deter the U.S. and the allies, the European Union, to do whatever is needed to do, because the bottom line is Putin has to understand that he is not going to own the Ukraine, and we're not going to give in on that.
And as these sanctions came into effect, the situation in eastern Ukraine seems to be escalating. We still have those military monitors being held by, we think, pro-Russian supporters. There is also reports of a Ukrainian mayor being shot and critically wounded. Will these sanctions actually have any impact or influence over what's being played out in eastern Ukraine?
No, I don't expect that. I think Putin is behind those. I think they have all the possibility to push back on the extremists. It's just not true that he has no leverage over them. And by the way, I think they crossed the line when they started taking hostages. I mean, this is ridiculous. Frankly, I think we should react swiftly and in a very tough manner to push back. Whether the sanctions will have an immediate impact on what they do in the Ukraine, that I doubt.
Former Hungarian ambassador to the US, András Simonyi. This is FSN Reports. Three members of the humanitarian organisation Doctors Without Borders were among 16 people killed over the weekend as violence in the Central African Republic continues. The incident occurred when armed militia attacked a hospital in the northern town of Boguila. As some of the gunmen robbed the office, others opened fire on civilians gathered at the health facility. Since a coup last year, the Central African Republic has witnessed increasing tensions and brutal violence. Tarak Bash Boab is a humanitarian affairs advisor for Doctors Without Borders, and he spoke to me earlier.
An armed group showed up on the premises and asked for the coffer of the organization and the place where we were holding cash to be emptied. So let's say it was a robbery going on. Part of the team members that were having the meeting were taken away from the meeting in order to respond to the armed robbery. A few minutes later, we heard some loud shooting and some repeated shootings. We didn't have much details about what was happening. And it is only at the end of the armed robbery, at about 4:15 or so, that the members of the team returned to the place where they were having the meeting with the local authorities and local community leaders, and at which spot of the hospital they found 16 bodies lying and being shot up, and three of those 16 bodies were members of our national staff, and 13 of the people that had been killed were some of our guests that had come earlier in the afternoon to have a discussion with us on access to healthcare in the area.
Tarak, was there a sense that this health facility was a high-risk target for an attack of this kind?
No, it is. Well, the main thing is it's the main hospital in the area for quite a large area. We have people reaching off from 30, 40 miles out and that access healthcare in that hospital. The hospital is well known to all the armed groups in the area, and so there is no possible confusion about what the area is, and it's open. It doesn't have any big walls or anything, but it is known as the MSF hospital in Boguila, as we've been working there for 8 years. So there could not have been any mistake about the fact that the armed group, the assailants, were in a hospital. It is probable that they were looking to get some money or some valuables for their own needs, and that for a reason that we are not sure of at this juncture, there was some kind of shooting happening with people that were visiting us in the hospital at that time.
And Tarak, how will this attack, this deadly incident, shape the work of Médecins Sans Frontières in the Central African Republic, in this particular region?
Well, after such an incident, we had no choice but to suspend our project. And this is really heart-wrenching because, as I mentioned, we were the only healthcare provider for a large population. The catchment area is about 45,000 people. We know, as I said, from the registers that we receive people from as far out as 40, 50 miles. We get pregnant women that come from the bush, from isolated rural areas to the hospital to do their antenatal checks and so on. So we know we were serving a lot of people, particularly in responding to malaria, which is the main number one killer in the country. And we have a lot of those cases coming every day to that hospital. Just to give you an idea, we do about between 10 and 15,000 consultations per month in that hospital for a catchment population of 45,000. So you realize fairly well that this hospital was serving a large number of people in a very large area. And we have had no choice but to suspend our project and to figure out if we would be able to restart operating in that area, looking at the risks that we're facing, that our teams are facing. And even if we have had incidents in the past and we have probably a high tolerance to some threats and some risks that we face, and we try to negotiate our ways so that people are clear about what we do and what we are, this incident is a serious threat to our ability to continue working in that area in the future.
And Tarak, lastly, you talk about it being a serious blow to thousands of people who desperately rely upon your medical assistance in that area. But what sort of level of security and protection are your members being afforded? And is that something that needs to be looked at?
Well, I think in general, we have a good understanding from the armed actors around us and from the authorities, from the populations who are obviously happy, I would say, or at least they are convinced of the relevance of our operations and our projects in the area. It seems like we have not been able to do enough in terms of being accepted by everybody and not having to face such incidents. We work very hard at negotiating our working space, and we felt that the hospital and the medical mission that MSF and Doctors Without Borders embodies would not be threatened and would not be put in jeopardy by whatever was happening around it, be it changes in regimes or changes in the control of armed groups. We felt we would be able to continue to provide essential medical assistance to these populations, but Saturday's incident throws that into question, and we will have to be to carefully analyze the reasons of why this happened and whether we would be able to restart work in the area and under what conditions.
Tarak Bash Boab, a humanitarian affairs advisor for Doctors Without Borders. Now, the relationship between church and state in Britain has been the subject of nationwide debate in recent weeks, as the Prime Minister and his coalition deputy aired conflicting opinions on the direction the country should take. With the story, FSN's Ollie Barrett.
I'm Ollie Barrett in London, where Britain's Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg has called for a full separation of church and state. His controversial comments divide the coalition government, made up of his Liberal Democrats and led by the Prime Minister's Conservative Party. And they have been rejected by Prime Minister David Cameron, whose own comments on faith started the debate. Mr. Cameron used Easter to assert his own Christian beliefs and say the UK remains a Christian country. This despite falling church attendance and falling rates of Christianity in what is increasingly a multi-faith country, and a country with rising numbers of people who say they have no faith. Nick Clegg was asked about the row by a listener on LBC Radio.
I'm wondering if you'd agree with me that David Cameron's statement that this is a Christian country is totally asinine and nonsense. No country can be a Christian country, and Muslim country, Hindu country. And do you not think that we should be keeping religion totally out of politics? I wouldn't have voted for him if I'd have known he was going to come out with all this.
Right.
But I did. But he won't get another vote from me.
Right. Well, look, Paul, I'm not a man of faith, but I don't actually find it particularly controversial to say, if you just look at our history, our heritage, our architecture,
our law,
our values, also, you know, of course it's infused by Christianity. And I in many ways, I was slightly nonplussed by people getting very worked up about it, because I thought, well, you know, I'm not a practicing man of faith, but I don't find it an issue to say, you know, we have an important sort of Christian identity in terms of our history and heritage and so on. That is not to say, Paul, which I think is maybe what lies behind your question, that somehow we are exclusively Christian, that we're somehow everybody is a Christian, or indeed that we've got one Christian denomination. There are almost as many Catholics as Anglicans in this country. And of course, we should remember that one of the greatest Christian values, if you want to put it that way, of tolerance, is that we are open to people of other denominations, other faiths, of all faiths and none. And I think that is what makes our country, it's this sense of fair play and tolerance, which I think makes our country very, very special. I mean, in more generally speaking, about the separation of religion and politics, as it happens, my personal view, I'm not pretending this is something which is discussed in the pubs and kitchen tables of Britain, but my personal view is in the long run, having the state and the church basically bound up with each other, as we do in this country, I think in the long run, it actually be better for the church and better for people of faith and better for Anglicans if the church and the state were over time to sort of stand on their own two separate feet, so to speak.
A final question from me. You may be aware, Prime Minister...
The government says it has no plans to disestablish the Church of England, the head of which is the Queen. Ollie Barrett, London.
Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, our new segment, taking an in-depth look at a story you might have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, a look at the risks associated with the transportation of oil. As the United States increasingly develops energy independence, the amount of oil transported by rail has quadrupled since 2005, and often with devastating effects. Last July, an unmanned train killed 47 people in Quebec when it came off the tracks and exploded in the town of Lac-Megantic. In December, a train in North Dakota struck another train, spilling 400 gallons of crude. In 2009, one person was killed when a train carrying ethanol derailed in Illinois. Last week, Canadian regulators announced plans to ban 5,000 older rail cars from transporting oil or other hazardous substances by the year 2017. Lisa Raitt is Canada's transport minister.
First thing Transportation Safety Board said in their recommendations was to take a look at the means of containment or the .111 cars. They've had concerns about them in the past, and we know that there's a group of these cars, there's about 5,000 of them, that don't have a continuous bottom that makes them more susceptible to breakage, and as a result we've given them 30 days to make sure that these are not carrying dangerous goods.
But what's happening on the US side of the border? Last week, Deborah Herzman, until yesterday the chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board, discussed the issue with Judy Woodruff, anchor of the PBS NewsHour.
The important thing to understand is we can prevent these accidents, so we've got to figure out how to prevent them. And that means keeping the trains from derailing in the first place or keeping them from having collisions. And so we've got to work on that. Most of these events are caused by either human failure, human factors issues, or track defects. And so we've got to fix those two issues. And then the second piece of it is the mitigation, the tank cars, and making those tank cars more crash-worthy if you do have an accident. And then the final piece of it is the response, because no community is prepared for a worst case scenario if you lose the entire contents of one of these unit trains.
So in terms of making the cars, making this transport safer, what needs to be done that isn't being done right now?
So I think focusing on the prevention, keeping the trains from derailing in the first place or those collisions from happening, that means the industry has to do a number of things. Do better inspections of the track, make sure that those trains don't collide, that your workers aren't fatigued, that they aren't tired. We've got to make sure that we prevent the accidents in the first place. But when it comes to the tank cars...
Let me just stop you there. Is that happening now?
Well, we do have some voluntary agreements from some of the railroads about reducing train speeds. That'll reduce some of the risk if there is a collision or an accident. and doing more frequent inspections of the rails. These are good things that people have agreed to do voluntarily, but more needs to be done because we really need to get to zero accidents, not just fewer accidents, but zero accidents. When it comes to the tank cars, there's a lot of conversation now about improving the crashworthiness and the integrity of these cars that are out there. And you talked about it, tens of thousands of them.
So should the U.S. do what the Canadian regulators have just today announced they're going to do, and that is require that the older cars be phased out?
That's, in fact, what the NTSB recommended several years ago. You showed earlier the Cherry Valley accident involving the ethanol train. We said they either need to retrofit or phase out these DOT 111 tank cars carrying crude or ethanol.
So it's already been recommended. Has it happened?
It has not happened. I think we certainly applaud the Canadians for taking swift action. And today we really challenge the U.S. regulators to follow suit, to move forward with safety improvements.
So where's the holdup? I mean, the reporting I've been reading today is that the railroad industry is saying these cars, among other things, they're saying these cars need to be upgraded. And they're looking to the oil industry, the oil companies, to do that upgrading. The oil companies are pushing back, saying, wait a minute, where's the evidence? How do you read all of this?
Well, I think clearly there are a lot of different interests here. We heard from the petroleum industry. We also heard from the rail industry. And we heard from the people who manufacture and own the tank cars. Everybody has got to work together to try to solve this problem. It's not going to go away if we don't invest in better tank cars and make sure we invest in preventing those accidents in the first place.
Does the NTSB, your agency, have the clout to make the things happen that need to happen?
We investigate the accidents and we make recommendations. It's up to other people to implement our recommendations. These recommendations have been on the books for several years. I think we're very disappointed that they haven't moved faster. But I'll tell you, this issue is getting a lot of attention now that we've had some accidents here on this side of the border. We've seen what happened in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec. I think a lot of politicians and others are paying attention, and there's pressure on the industry and the regulators to make a change.
And I assume that's part of the reason you're here tonight to talk about.
That's right.
To talk about this. But I was also reading today, Deborah Hersman, that among other things, the oil industry is being criticized for not being transparent enough about the cargo it carries, how it carries it, its own safety rules and regulations. Help us understand that a little better.
You know, I think the important thing to understand here is this boom is a really good thing when we talk about energy independence for the United States. It's a good thing for U.S. jobs, and it is. There's a lot of good here, but you have to do the work that needs to be done to protect the safety of the people who are working along the lines, people who live along the lines, and the environment. And unfortunately, they got way ahead with the business case, and the safety regulations were not there keeping track.
You mean the oil industry got way ahead.
The oil industry, they found this oil and they were extracting it. And the rail industry, these unit trains, 100 car trains of crude oil or ethanol, they're really essentially moving pipelines.
Deborah Hersman, who until just yesterday was the chair of the National Transportation Safety Board. She was talking to the PBS NewsHour's Judy Woodruff.
With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the show by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there @featurestory. Coming up on Tuesday, FSN's interview with David Phillips, this year's winner of the Pulitzer Prize in National Reporting. That's Tuesday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.